on a Thursday. Welcome into the show that shakes the Southland. This is the Y'all Show, the general of all things Southern. I am John Rawl. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy, busy day to catch up with what's going on across the South. We've got a combination of news to pass along here on this Thursday edition. We've got the sports that we want to make sure we cover with you. In fact, we will continue our coverage of ACC Media Days from Charlotte today on the program. You're going to hear from a couple of more ACC coaches. I know on the Wednesday show you heard from the coach of Georgia Tech, Brent Key, as well as the head coach. Let me go back in time. Who did I have on the Wednesday show in addition to Brent Key of Georgia Tech? We had Mario Cristobal of Miami, that's right. And then we had the ACC commissioner. Yeah. See, I've already put Wednesday in the rearview mirror. Today, in hour one, we're going to hear from the second-year coach of the Virginia Cavaliers, Tony Elliott. He was at the podium on Wednesday in Charlotte, and we'll have his coverage from ACC kickoff to tell you about the former Clemson coordinator who is now leading the Hoos in Charlottesville. We'll hear from him. In hour two today, we're going to hear from the head coach of the Florida State Seminoles, Mike Norvell, the former Memphis Tiger coach, and find out how things are going in T-Town, Tallahassee, as the Noles, a much improved program in 2022. We'll find out exactly what he has in store for 2023 as Mike Norvell. We'll hear from him in hour two. Hour three today, we'll hear from the head coach of... Now, I've got the wrong school, but I've got the right coach's name. Sorry. I don't know what I was doing when I was getting this all typed up. Duke's head coach is who I've got. And he actually ended up being last year the ACC Coach of the Year, Mike Elko. And I don't know why I wasn't paying close enough attention to Duke, but they had a pretty dang good year last year, y'all. I mean, they really did. They came within a whisker of winning what would have been in 2022 the Coastal Division. Now, this year, the ACC has ditched divisions, just like the SEC is going to do in 24. And so we've got Duke's head coach, Mike Elko, from ACC Media Days. We'll play for you in our final hour. And speaking of all the conference stuff, we'll have the latest on Colorado. It looks like the Buffaloes today are jumping conferences from the Pac-12 to the Big 12. What is that all about? Is that because of prime time? Number 21, Deion Sanders, but number one in your heart, Deion Sanders. Has his impact in Boulder already led that program out of the Pac-12 and back into the Big 12? We'll have the latest conference possible realignment talk on our sports reports today. We've got plenty of sports coming your way, and then we've got hashtag HuddleBlue coming up in just a few minutes here on hour one of the program. We've got hashtag HuddleBlue where we're going to look at, okay, we know people don't like each other when it comes to college football, which is about a month away now, but what about just pure hatred of other states? We've got a map that shows in your state what state you hate the most, and I'm going to walk through it. It's pretty funny. I think it's pretty funny. And so we'll let you know who hates who coming up a little bit later this hour. Hour two today, we've got our country music news and notes. It's the Nashville Music Line Report. Chris Stapleton has just named his new album. We're going to tell you more about what the Kentucky native and Vanderbilt alum is planning for new music. Plus, a reunited Billy Currington and Shania Twain. They got together, and I'm going to tell you about it. Not getting together. They just got together on stage, and they've had musical getting together before, as they've had a song that they've had out. And these two back, and I'll tell you where, how, why, and when in our country music news and notes coming up in hour number two. Hour three today, we will have, in addition to the headlines and sports news of the day, our weekend travel report. If you have nothing going on, I'm giving you enough heads up today that you can load up the car and head out to a bunch of great festivals across the Southeast this very weekend. Let me give you just a little sample of what's going on out here this weekend. Okay, you ready for this? In West Virginia, this weekend they've got their hot dog festival. I don't know if Joey Chestnut's going to be coming to that, but that's going on this weekend. In Arkansas, it's the Peacemaker Festival, and there is a huge lineup of musicians that we're going to be going to the Peacemaker Festival, and I'll tell you who and where that's going on this weekend. By the way, speaking of weekend, this is not a festival, but if you're lucky enough to get a ticket, this weekend in, of all places, Nashville, George Strait is playing at Nissan Stadium. If you got a ticket out there and you don't mind having a good old country boy named John come along, let me know, because I've never seen King George in concert. I've seen him, just not in concert. Just drop me an email if you don't mind. mail@y'all.com. I'll be searching nonstop. And I'll pay for it. mail@y'all.com. I'm not looking for a freebie. But boy, it'd be awesome to see him. Cool cat there, George Strait. Okay, other festivals this weekend. You got in St. Genevieve, Missouri. That's not all that far from St. Louis. And it's not all that far from Cape Girardeau, sort of in southeast Missouri. This weekend, there is a tiger festival going on. And the reason that's going on is, did you realize there's a very big tiger sanctuary in St. Genevieve, Missouri, right on the Mississippi River? And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about this place and how they rescue tigers and give them a very happy home right there near the Boot Hill of Missouri. And that's a tiger festival they've got there in St. Genevieve going on this weekend. So we'll have all that in our Southern Travel Report. It's going to be fun. So there you have it. There is a slice of what's going on across the South today on the Y'all Show. And I want to tell you, I'm not going to get to this story this hour, but in our news stories today, you're going to really learn a lot, because I'm going to introduce something you probably didn't grow up learning in school. You didn't learn this when you were studying civics. We're going to learn today all about the Lacey Act. What the heck is the Lacey Act? Well, the reason it's in the news, there's actually a story that involves Mississippi and Tennessee and some guys who did something with a white-tailed deer. And it's a violation of the Lacey Act. What is it? Well, just stay tuned and I'll tell you all about it in our news headlines today. All right, let's get into the other news headlines of today. And the big story from Wednesday was Hunter Biden's plea deal on hold now, after federal judge in Wilmington, Delaware, raised concerns over the terms of the agreement. Where's Hunter? Well, on Wednesday, he was back in his native Delaware, where he thought he was just going to be able to waltz into the court, take care of business, put on his Joe Biden aviators, and head on back to his illegal activity, whatever that might be. But not so fast, my friend, as Lee Corso would say. The plea deal that he had thought he had worked out came apart during this court hearing on Wednesday. The federal judge raised concerns about the terms of the agreement that has made a lot of Republicans, and you'll see them on Fox News and other TV channels, really upset because they believe the president's son is getting preferential treatment. Hunter was charged back in June with two misdemeanor crimes of failure to pay more than $100,000 in taxes from over $1.5 million in income during the years 2017 and 2018. And he had been expected to plead guilty while in Wilmington at the court there on Wednesday after he made this agreement with prosecutors. And they were planning to recommend 2 years of probation for the little Biden. Prosecutors said Wednesday that Hunter Biden remains under active investigation but would not give details. The district judge there in Wilmington, Mary Ellen Noreika, who was appointed by Donald Trump, she raised concerns about the specifics of the deal and her role in the proceedings. The plan also included an agreement on a separate gun charge, as Hunter has been accused of possessing a firearm back in 2018 as a drug user. Not going to do that. You're not supposed to have guns when you're a druggie, as Hunter Biden evidently is, or certainly has been in the past. So this was quite a little bit of an unexpected twist in this tale. And so the Hunter Biden problem continues. if you were a Hunter Biden fan, you're hoping this thing ends up being in probation, it's forgotten about, and Hunter does not continue to bring down his father. Of course, the other side of this story is that there's something going on here. And if in the end, Hunter Biden can't get away from some of these charges and is convicted, what's daddy going to do, especially if these are federal charges? Is daddy going to give him a pardon? And if that happens, is daddy guaranteed to lose to whoever the Republican is because he sacrificed his son and his son's jail time for winning an election? He might just do that. He might just do that. But again, Hunter Biden continued to causing problems. Now, back in 2019, he said he was not currently in any kind of drug treatment, Hunter. But we just found cocaine at the White House the other day. And it's very strange that nobody saw where that came from. And this is not going to be a story or a case that's going to bring the country down. But it sure looked like this was a fast track to, it's who you know. It's who you know that can get you off. It's who you know and the powerful and the rich to get away with murder. That's not what we're accusing. I'm just saying metaphorically, that's what the Hunter Biden case is kind of like. And the judge there not playing along with the scheme, at least on Wednesday, this will probably go to somebody else, and ultimately, the Bidens will come out of this as bloodless as possible. But not expected what happened on Wednesday, I'm sure, on their side of the legal proceedings. More legal issues for Rudy Giuliani. Now, this ties into Georgia. That's why we're bringing it up here today, because the former mayor of New York City and a one-time prosecutor that was world-renowned in his work as the, I think he was the Manhattan, or whatever they call that in New York for federal judges, the first lower district of New York, I think it's what it's called. Rudy Giuliani has conceded that he made public comments that were not true, claiming that two Georgia election workers committed ballot fraud during the 2020 election. But he's arguing that those statements are protected by the First Amendment. I wonder where he said those statements. The belief was that Giuliani, who was then in 2020 part of Donald Trump's legal team, he tried to overturn results in battleground states. And this revelation that he's made a lie about these election workers came in a filing earlier this week in a lawsuit by Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss. Their lawsuit that was filed in December of 2021 accuses the former mayor of defaming them by falsely stating that they had engaged in fraud while counting ballots at State Farm Arena in Atlanta. That was a big polling hub in Atlanta during the 2020 election. Their lawsuit says that Giuliani repeatedly pushed debunked claims that Freeman and Moss, who are a mother and daughter, by the way, that they pulled out suitcases of illegal ballots and committed other acts of fraud to try to alter the outcome of the race. Giuliani is not disputing that the statements were false, but he does not concede that they caused any damage to Freeman or Moss. Again, he's going to say that he had the First Amendment protection to say that they were bringing out fake ballots. I thought it was Cobb County, where there was some kind of video showing shenanigans going on during that vote counting. I haven't studied this stuff like a lot of you out there have, but I never saw anything coming out of State Farm Arena, and evidently that's where these two ladies, the mother and daughter team, were working on election night. And Rudy Giuliani has seized on that, and again has already admitted that he made some false claims. So Rudy, you might just have to pay up. I don't think he's going to have to go to jail for making a claim like that, but boy, a lot of venom being spewed back then and still on the election of 2020. We may never get past that one. And you know what? We've got a presidential election right around the daggum corner. An update on a story out of Mississippi. This happened a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was strange at the time, but I'm going to let you all know about this because it's getting more traction. A 16-year-old worker at a poultry plant died. And the question is, how could this have happened? A 16-year-old working in a poultry plant? Child labor laws? What are the rules? And again, this happened when Devon Perez became the third teenager to die in an industrial accident in America this summer. And now there's a push by lawmakers in some states to loosen child labor regulations in order to meet the demand for workers. So there are lawmakers pushing to make 16-year-olds be more available, it sounds like. Devon Perez was working on a sanitation crew at the Marjack Poultry July 14th when he became entangled in a conveyor belt that he was cleaning and ended up losing his life at that plant in Mississippi. So, I know that we have youngsters, and I love to see the youngsters out there working, but it's a little weird that they're working in some of these big plants. A 16-year-old died earlier this month after he became entangled in a wood stacking machine in Wisconsin, and a youngster named Will Hampton, a 16-year-old, died in June when he was pinned between a semi-truck and its trailer at a landfill in Lee's Summit, Missouri. So three 16-year-olds all dying while working this summer. State and federal child labor laws prohibit minors from working in meat processing plants. And there are, I was goofing off the other day, and a 15-year-old served me ice cream. And I guess that's illegal to work at 15. I was working younger than that, but it was more of a family thing. But I got a paycheck. I didn't get a paycheck. I got an envelope stuffed with cash, which is not a bad deal when you're 11 and 12 years old. Again, but that was on the family farm. So just something to be on the lookout. Senior Labor Department officials have expanded their enforcement efforts, saying that the department has completed 765 child labor investigations and have identified over 4,400 children employed in violation of federal child labor laws in this year alone. Again, there's such a demand for workers that some places are bringing in youngsters. In fact, the Department of Labor announcing Tuesday that it had fined a couple of McDonald's franchises in Louisiana and Texas for employing teen workers for longer hours than allowed by law, and also letting 14 and 15-year-olds operate manual deep fryers and trash compactors. Such work is prohibited for employees under the age of 16. Just something to keep in mind. In fact, if you're a youngster and you're 14 and 15 and 16 listening to me, you might want to double check your federal child labor laws, because we don't want you in violation, and we don't want, I know these places are so desperate for workers. We really don't want them getting in any kind of trouble if they can avoid it at any cost. An update on two stories we told you about Wednesday. The three Marines that were found unresponsive at a gas station 30 miles from Camp Lejeune where they were stationed. According to police in North Carolina where this happened, these three Marines died of carbon monoxide poisoning. The North Carolina Office of Medical Examiner determined the cause of the Marine's death after autopsies on all three. Just a sad story. I thought that might be what it was. The Lance Corporals identified by the Marine Corps as 19-year-old Tanner Kaltenberg, a native of Madison, Wisconsin, also dying when these three were found at a gas station, a raceway, 30 minutes from Camp Lejeune, an Oklahoma native, Marax C. Dockery, he was 23 years old, and then a 23-year-old out of Naples, Florida, Lance Corporal Yvonne Garcia. All three who were stationed at Lejeune died from carbon monoxide poisoning. They were all three in a car at this gas station and were found earlier in the week. Sad story. Another update on the story we told you about on Wednesday. We told you how the state treasurer of Arkansas, Mark Lowry, was going to step aside after having some health woes. He's going to step aside. I think it was in the end of September. He announced just Tuesday that he was going to retire. He was sworn in as treasurer just this year, sworn in with the new Governor Sanders regime, if you want to call it that, out of Arkansas. On Wednesday, the state treasurer of Arkansas, Mark Lowry, died. Unexpectedly. He had already suffered two strokes this year, and he announced that he was going to retire early, but Wednesday, he died unexpectedly. So Arkansas without a state treasurer right now, and our thoughts there with the family and with the entire state of Arkansas as they grieve the loss of their state treasurer, again with an unexpected death, just a sad turn of events out of Little Rock. In Tennessee, teachers are suing over state restrictions on the CRT curriculum, and they say that the laws need to be clear. The largest teachers union in the volunteer state suing the state over these restrictions. TEA, Tennessee Education Association, along with five other public school educators, filing a lawsuit against the Tennessee Commissioner of Education, as well as members of the State Board of Education, to challenge the constitutionality of the restrictions placed on teaching racial and gender issues. This lawsuit, again, filed Wednesday, challenges the prohibited concepts law, which was passed in 2021, and that bans certain subjects and topics from being taught in classrooms. The union claims the law prohibits teaching of core subjects in Tennessee state standards, which puts teachers in an impossible position and deprives students of a quality education. That a statement from this union when they filed this in Music City earlier this week. And lastly, in our headlines for hour number one, the House Speaker of the state of Alabama is getting a little attention. Nathaniel Ledbetter is a Republican out of Rainesville, which is on Sand Mountain in northeast Alabama. And Representative, our House Speaker is his title, House Speaker Ledbetter, said that Nancy Pelosi, she needs to pipe down after she called the controversial congressional map that Alabama's trying to get approved, and it's being worked on right there where Ledbetter works in the Alabama State House. And he said that she needs to pipe down, and it's completely, totally ridiculous, according to Ledbetter. The former House Speaker Pelosi, I guess that would be his fellow House Speaker. One is the current House Speaker in Alabama. The other is the former U.S. House Speaker. But Pelosi, she went off on Alabama, making comments on an appearance over the weekend on State of the Nation. But if you follow this case, Alabama has been slapped for trying to draw their new congressional maps. And there's only one black majority district historically in Alabama. I guess the Supreme Court says you got to have two or something along those lines. And then Ledbetter and his fellow Republicans in Montgomery came up with a new map. And guess what? It's not going to fly, at least with the Supreme Court. And so it's ticking people off. In fact, Nathaniel Ledbetter of Rainesville, Alabama, he's ticked off as he went on social media and put the following post: thanks to Speaker Pelosi's leadership, America is tanking in debt. Families have to spend $13,000 more a year, and criminals are running our streets. Alabama is doing better than the feds because we don't take advice from liberal activists like Nancy. Hashtag pipe down Pelosi. And again, last week in Montgomery, their new, the Ledbetter and others led House in Montgomery passed a new congressional map that was signed into law by Kay Ivey. And it was a compromise version approved by Republicans on a conference committee. But again, like earlier versions of this congressional map proposed, it did not add a second majority black district. The U.S. Supreme Court back in June affirmed a three-judge district court ruling that Alabama's current map violates the Voting Rights Act by diluting the black vote. What if all of the districts ended up being led by blacks from North Alabama to South Alabama? Maybe they were all black Republicans. Yeah, it could happen. It should. Maybe it should happen. I'm not totally sure it would ever happen, but yes, Pelosi and Alabama getting a little dust up here this week. And that is a look at some of the Hour 1 news headlines right here on the show that keeps you informed with everything going on across the Southeast. We're going to take a break. When we come back on the Y'all Show, we're going to scoot over to our sports desk and give you the latest on what's going on sports-wise across the Southeast. Plus, we will let you hear from the head coach of the Virginia Cavaliers, Tony Elliott. He was at ACC Media Days on Wednesday. We've got some audio from the young skipper. All that's coming up as the Y'all Show Thursday edition continues. Hoos fans, we're just a few weeks away from Virginia football kicking off. Welcome back. It is the show that shakes the Southland. We are y'all, and we've got our Southern Sports Report going on right this moment. We've got coverage of the ACC football media days as that's going down in Uptown Charlotte this week. This Y'all Show Thursday edition is going to feature Tony Elliott here in a moment. He is the head coach of those Hoos. UVA coach at the mic on Wednesday. Hour two today, we're going to hear from Mike Norvell, the skipper of the Florida State Seminoles. And in our final hour today, we've got Duke head football coach Mike Elko. You'll be hearing from all three ACC coaches as we give you the coverage of what's going on with the Atlantic Coast Conference. We're going to hear from Elliott in just a moment, but the big breaking story from college football on this Thursday is what's going on with Colorado. As it appears, the Buffs are Big 12 bound. As the Big 12, the actual members on Wednesday, the member institutions, all voting unanimously to accept Colorado as a member. So it looks like it's already going to happen in Boulder. Why else would the Big 12 vote to unanimously accept Colorado? At some point today, and it may have already happened, the Buffaloes are expected to join the Big 12. They're going to move out of the Pac-12 and go in to the Big 12, a conference they were members of for some around 15 years. And then they decided to move off to the Big 12, Pac-12, and they have not won a bowl game since they joined the Pac-12. Now, I know prime time's going to change all that, but Colorado having a special board meeting with an agenda item today called Action Item Athletics Operations. That's on the menu in Colorado today. All this being fueled by the fact that the contract that the Pac-12 conference has from a television standpoint is going to expire with the end of this current season. If Colorado wants to bolt to the Big 12, they can do it and not be fined. It's a perfect move. So if this happens, and it looks like it's going to happen, Colorado will be back with a bunch of their former Big 8 members, teams like Oklahoma State. They'll be back with Kansas and Kansas State. So they've got a little history. They won't be back playing Missouri, as Missouri in the SEC. That was an old rivalry between Colorado and Mizzou. There used to be some good games between Colorado and Nebraska, but unfortunately, Nebraska not in the Big 12. I wish they were. I don't think Nebraska's personally that great of a fit in the Big 10 is where they are. But the Buffs and Coach Primetime Sanders, looks like they're moving conferences. And is that going to cause what the good old former commissioner of the SEC used to tell me at Media Days in Birmingham, a paradigm shift? I had a good time with Mike Slive talking to him about paradigm shifts. I'd never heard that term until the lawyer, Mr. Slive, educated me on that word. I didn't go to law school, at least not yet. I went to y'all school. That's what I got my degree in. And so I think you're going to have other teams certainly look to be added. The Big 12 this year has, I think, 14 teams, as Oklahoma and Texas will be leaving after this year. So you add Colorado next year, that's 13 teams. Surely they want to add one more team. Who's that going to be? Who is going to be that 14th member of the Big 12? Ooh, I know they're getting excited on Beale Street. They're getting excited on Highland. The Memphis Tigers, is that you? Are you going to get the call to join the Big 12? Are you finally going to move up to a true Power 5 conference? I don't think so. I really don't. I think Utah is going to be courted to join the Big 12. Why? Because BYU has just joined that conference. So you could have the two big schools out of that state come on into the Big 12. I think it's not completely impossible for Tulane to be courted to join the Big 12, or possibly SMU. But that's why I love this whole conference stuff, man. It's exciting. I think it's exciting. It's fun. NFL teams currently in camp. We'll cover that as we go on through the show. But let's keep the college football talk going. At ACC kickoff, that was going down day two on Wednesday. Tony Elliott was at the podium as he gets ready to enter his second season leading the Virginia Cavaliers. This is a guy who for many years was a coordinator for the Clemson Tigers, leading them to national championships during the Dabo Swinney era, which continues in Tiger Town. But they just don't have Tony Elliott. In fact, hey, without Tony Elliott, let's be real, y'all, Clemson was not as good last year. They were certainly nowhere close to what they had been. They lost to the Gamecocks, for God's sakes. So Elliott, the California-born head coach, who was a wide receiver back during the Tommy Bowden era at Clemson as he wrapped up his playing career in 2003 and then went on to be, for the most part, an assistant at Clemson, where his last job there was the assistant head coach and offensive coordinator. And he got the job at Virginia. His head coaching job at Virginia, his first season, was not very good. He was 3-7. But it was a tumultuous time in Charlottesville. Remember, right there at the end of the year, they had a former player kill two other members of that football team, and a real tragedy. That tragedy resulted in Virginia canceling its last two games. They did not play Virginia Tech, their rivalry game, and they did not play, I forgot who they were scheduled to play, but they had a horrible, horrible 2022. So you almost have to pretend that last year did not happen for Elliott, in my opinion. And Elliott on Wednesday talked about the grief and the recovery and just what his team is going to do to try to get beyond that tragedy. Let's go in and hear now the head coach of the Virginia Cavaliers, Tony Elliott, from ACC Media Days Wednesday in Charlotte.
Yeah, first and foremost, got to thank the college football community, which includes all of you guys and everybody across the country for just the outpour of support. We felt it in Charlottesville, and the same thing with the community of Charlottesville, the University of Virginia, our student body. Everybody came to our side immediately. While we were in shock, trying to regain our footing from what just happened, they held us up in the interim until we could kind of get ourselves grounded and figure out how we're going to navigate forward. And you know, this situation is unprecedented. There's no preparation. And even though I experienced tragedy as a young person and throughout the course of my life, it still doesn't prepare you for a situation like this. And the way that you get through it is together. And that's the beauty of football. It's an ultimate team sport, and it forces you to sacrifice and rely on somebody else. And it forces you to do hard things that you may not want to do because you have a connection and a bond and a love for your teammates. And so these guys really is what gave me the inspiration to lead, because it's very difficult in a situation like that. Know what to say, know what to do, and then to even gain to have an understanding of is it working, and trying to figure out, you know, how to lead not just the players but the staff and then also the athletic department, you know, through that situation. But these guys accepted the challenge, right? They understood that they have a responsibility to Lavelle, Devin, and Deshaun to move forward in the right way. Not moving on, there's a difference. That was a big message within the program is, you know, we're not moving on. We're never going to forget this. We're not going to put this to the side and act like it didn't happen. Unfortunately for us, it's our new normal. It's a part of our lives and will be a part of our lives forever. And we'll constantly be reminded of it. And there's going to be tough days. And they learned that they have to lean on each other in tough days. They also learned, you know, the importance of football, you know, the structure that it provides, the safe haven that it provides, the community that it provides. So to watch these guys every single day, they made a decision, right? The guys that came back in January made a decision to embrace the hard and live it every single day. And these guys have done it beyond, you know, any expectations that I had of them. And it started with just having an attitude of gratitude and appreciation for life. I think for us that are in it, and hopefully going forward, anybody that has a connection to our program will see that, you know, it's bigger than us. And ultimately, as we all chase purpose in life, we realize that purpose is not about me. It's about what I can do for others. And they didn't ask for this. University of Virginia didn't ask for this, you know, but we were given, you know, this opportunity. Tremendous challenge, but we were given an opportunity, and the opportunity that we see is that we can take something that, you know, is unexplainable, unprecedented, very, very difficult, right? You wouldn't wish it on anybody, and we can find the beauty of it and use it to inspire others going forward by the way that we respond, by the way that we play, by the way that they live, by the way that they go forward in the future, and the individual ways that they decide that they want to honor the legacies of Lavelle, Devin, and Deshaun.
All right, that was the head coach of the Virginia Cavaliers, again, from ACC Media Days in Charlotte. And what more can you say? I mean, what an awful, awful thing that happened to that football program last year with those players getting killed by a former teammate of theirs, and it caused their last two games to get canceled. And we usually talk more about the X's and O's, but I thought that statement from Elliott was just so strong. And what other way to capture what he had on his mind by giving him an opportunity to talk about how that impacted his football team? Tony Elliott, again, that was the head coach of the Virginia Cavaliers at Media Days in Charlotte on Wednesday. We've got Mike Norvell coming up, hour number two. We've got Mike Elko, head coach of the Duke Blue Devils, headed your way in hour three as we will continue our coverage of the Atlantic Coast Conference's football paparazzi event. All right. When we come back, we're going to wrap up this hour with some fun stuff from hashtag Hullabaloo. That is right ahead on the Y'all Show.
Sitting there beside me, throwing doubles down. When he ordered up his third one, he looked around. Then he looked at me and said, I do believe I'll have one more. He said, I hate this bar and I hate to drink, but on second thought, tonight I think I hate everything. Then he opened up his billfold and threw a 20 down, and the faded photograph fell out and hit the ground. And I picked it up. He said, "Thank you, bud." I put it in his hand. He said, "I probably ought to throw this one away, 'cause she's the reason I feel this way. Why, I hate everything. Why, I hate my job. Hate my life."
A lot of hate going on in that song from King George. You know, I just talked about him a couple of minutes ago, so it's only fitting that we play a little straight music here. But that one is all about hate, and we're all about love here at the Y'all Show. At least we are normally. But we start this segment of hashtag Hullabaloo with hate on our mind, because we found a graphic courtesy of the Instagram page at Matt Shirley's is the name. MattSurlee. Check it out. Matt Shirley. And he's got a post. I have no idea where this information came from to make this graphic, but it is a graphic of every single United States state. And it shows every state's least favored state. And I've got the breakdown here. Are y'all ready for this? When we look at our southern map, what states hate the other state? Well, Texas, the home of one George Strait, Texas's least favored state is Oklahoma. Oklahoma's least favorite state, yeah, you guessed it, Texas. New Mexico also dislikes Texas, in case you're wondering. Moving over a little bit to the Mississippi River area, the states of Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Do you know who they hate the most? Alabama. Congratulations, Alabama. Kentucky hates Tennessee. And guess what? Tennessee hates Kentucky. Oh, what are they doing in places like Fulton and South Fulton in Tennessee and Kentucky? Those two great towns that are literally a chip shot away from each other. They truly do hate each other. And keeping that kind of fun going, you got the states of Virginia and West Virginia. And you know what? Guess what? In Virginia, their least favorite state, it would be West Virginia. And West Virginia's least favorite state, and you can add Maryland too, both West Virginia and Maryland hate Virginia. Yeah, Virginia jealousy going on there. The state of North Carolina hates South Carolina. And then you got the three states. Now we're going to have some fun, okay? When we go south on the southeastern portion of the southeast, when you get down, I'm going to say South Carolina for last because it truly is the best one, I think. But how about this? Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, they all hate the same state. You know what state that is? They hate Florida. That's right. Florida hates Florida. On this graphic. And then the good state of South Carolina, bless your heart. I love this because this one is really the one that is probably the most accurate. South Carolina's least favorite state. And I can tell you it's absolutely correct here too. Is Ohio. That's right. South Carolina's tired of all you dang Ohio people coming down to the Palmetto State and bringing your Yankee ways. And you know what? This Instagram map is pretty dang accurate. Yeah, South Carolina hates Ohio. Amen to that. Love it. And that's hashtag Hullabaloo for this hour. Got a lot more fun coming up in the hours 2 and 3 of this, the Y'all Show. John Rawl inviting you to hang on for more of the Dixie fun on the show that shakes the Southland.
It's really not a home. It's more like a jail.
Thank you.
welcome back in to the show All About the South. We are the Y'all Show. John Rawl. Rawl rhymes with y'all, y'all. And we are glad that you could take time to join us on this Thursday edition as we cover the news, sports, and other happenings across the 16 southern states. If you'd like to check in with us, you're welcome to do that. We have an email address that you can drop us a line anytime. Mail, M-A-I-L, at y'all.com. Mail at y'all.com. And for all of our podcast listeners out there who are catching us on all kinds of neat platforms like Spotify, the iHeartRadio app, the TuneIn app, plus we're on Apple Podcasts and Apple iTunes. We appreciate all you who get us that way. Hey, don't feel like you have to be left out. You can drop us an email, but you can also text us. We've got a 24-hour-a-day text line, 615-208-4184. So that's how you can reach us here at the Y'all Show. I want to appreciate all of you catching this, no matter what way, on the radio, on podcast, or if you're catching us second-handed, maybe you got somebody who relays every episode that we have done, then we appreciate that too. Going to have a good time here in hour two. We've got more headlines from across the South that we're going to jump into. Plus, we got country music news straight out of Music Row in Nashville. Chris Stapleton's got a new album forthcoming. I'm going to tell you about that. Plus, Shanae and Billy Currington teaming up again. I'll have the juicy details of that. Plus, before the hour is up today, we're going to go back to Charlotte for the ACC Football Media Days, and we'll hear from the former head coach of the Memphis Tigers, currently now coaching the Florida State Seminoles. Mike Norvell spoke at ACC Media Days, and we'll hear what the guy who did a much better job in 2022 than he did in previous years. Oh, yeah, they still talk about that loss to Jacksonville State down in Tallahassee and throughout the rest of the South, frankly. Way to go, Gamecocks. Back in, I think it was 21, they had an incredible victory there at Doak Campbell. But Mike Norvell, much improved Noles team, letting them go to the bowl game in Orlando. I remember when that was going on at the end of the 2022 season. I guess it would have been roughly 28 December when the Noles played in that bowl game. But we're going to hear from the coach of the Noles this hour, Mike Norvell, and bring you up to date on if there's been any developments on the whole Colorado to Big 12. That looks like that's happening, and we'll find out if the smoke has come out of the building there in Boulder to signify a change of conference, and is this going to set off more teams moving around before we get to 2025. We got a bunch of teams shifting this year, a few more shifting next year. Is this ever going to settle down? Are we going to be one big, happy football conference when it's all said and done? All of that coming up in our sports coverage later this hour. Let's get into the news headlines of the day. And the big national story from Wednesday was Hunter Biden, as his plea deal now on hold after a Trump-appointed judge decided to not let him skate through, as that was what appeared to be happening. But this federal judge in Wilmington, Delaware, meeting with Hunter Biden on Wednesday, and it looks like his plea deal not going to happen quite as fast as his case unraveled during a court hearing after the judge raised concerns about the terms of the agreement. This agreement has made a lot of Republicans mad over the last few weeks. Biden was charged in June with two misdemeanor crimes of failure to pay more than $100,000 in taxes from over $1.5 million in income during the years 2017 and 2018. Prosecutors Wednesday in Wilmington said that Hunter Biden remains under active investigation. But the judge, Judge Mary Ellen Norica, raised multiple concerns about the specifics of the deal and her role in the proceedings. So this, according to some of the talking heads on TV from the conservative side, this was not a good move for Hunter Biden. And his objective of making this thing go away as quickly as possible and as painless as possible, it looks like it's going to be on hold for a while after this judge raised concerns over the terms of the plea deal that he set up, which I thought was very weird. And I won't say illegal because I don't claim to be a legal scholar myself. But remember, out of nowhere, it comes out in June that Hunter Biden's reached a plea deal with the feds. And he hadn't really, and as far as I know, been charged. So you can just set up a plea deal without ever having formal charges leveled against you. That, I think, is what happened. And for conservatives, they're thinking this would never have happened if the shoe was on the other foot. And they might just have something to that. Giuliani is in the news. That would be Rudy, the former New York City mayor and a one-time federal prosecutor that was pretty dang good at that job, which catapulted him to the mayor's office in the Bronx and Manhattan and Queens and Brooklyn and Harlem. I guess that's the, or Staten Island, the five boroughs of New York City. I should shut up talking about New York City because they can have it. I want to talk about not New York City, but Oklahoma City, or perhaps, what's another place in the South that's got city? Mississippi City. Do y'all know where that is? That's right by Gulfport. It was where the University of Mississippi was supposed to go, but by one vote, they put it in a place called Oxford. Let's see here. Pell City, that's in Alabama. Don't want to leave them out. Alexander City is in Alabama. Yeah, Alabama's got two of them. All right, let me get back to talking about Rudy Giuliani. And I just get so carried away talking about the South. All right, and if you got your favorite, by the way, that lets me get interactive with y'all. If you have your favorite city in the South, that the city is a part of your city name, then email that to me. We'll have some fun going through that. M-A-I-L, mail at y'all.com. I think Murray City, don't want to leave them out. That's a great West Tennessee town. Murray, M-A-U-R-Y City. Murray City is one of our city places here in the South. We got a few of them. You just have to sit back and think about it for a while. But yeah, and Oklahoma City, don't want to forget about them. That's kind of a big deal here. But yeah, check it out. M-A-I-L at y'all.com is how you can reach us. Now back to Rudy Giuliani. So he has evidently admitted that he made false public comments where he claimed that two Georgia ladies, a mother and daughter team, and that would be Ruby Freeman and her daughter Shay Moss. I think I got that right. Rudy Giuliani made false accusations against this duo. And he claims that they had engaged in fraud while counting ballots while in Atlanta during the 2020 election when they were at State Farm Arena where the Atlanta Hawks play, but they turned that into a massive voting center back in 2020. And the lawsuit filed by these two ladies claims that Rudy Giuliani repeatedly pushed debunk claims that they pulled out suitcases of illegal ballots and committed other acts of fraud to try to alter the outcome of the race. And now Rudy Giuliani, say that five times fast, is conceding that he made false claims. I mean, that's not very good for Rudy Giuliani. He's going to have to pay up, it looks like. We'll keep our eye on this developing story again. Any day now, Fonnie Willis, the DA there in Fulton County, is going to have to make a decision, and I'm sure she's going to proceed with charges indicting Donald Trump on the whole Georgia election fiasco. I can almost guarantee that's going to happen. But it hasn't happened yet, so we'll keep our eye on Fulton County for you. Three Marines that died, we told you about this Wednesday, that died in North Carolina, found in a car at a Raceway gas station in Hempstead, North Carolina. The local office of the medical examiner of North Carolina has now determined that these three Marines died in their car from carbon monoxide poisoning. The Pender County, North Carolina Sheriff's Office found the three men in a car outside this convenience store early on Sunday. And these three Marines, again, dying of carbon monoxide poisoning in their car. Lance Corporals Tanner Kaltenberg of Wisconsin, Oklahoma native Marax Dockery, who was 23, and another 23-year-old out of Naples, Florida, Yvonne Garcia, all dying. They were stationed at Camp Lejeune, which was about 30 miles away from this gas station, and they were found dead in this car. A true tragedy from this week. Also, an update we told you about from Wednesday, the state treasurer of Arkansas, Mark Lowry, announced earlier in the week that he was going to retire after a couple of strokes that he had. He was going to retire unexpectedly, and he announced that September 30th would be the day he stepped aside. Guess what? Sad news. Wednesday, Lowry died. He died while still in office as Arkansas's state treasurer. Our thoughts for everybody there in the state of Arkansas, the natural state, grieving the loss of their state treasurer right now. Other headlines across the southeast. A black fraternity has decided to move their convention out of Florida over racist policies. Alpha Phi Alpha has announced that it's going to move its convention from Orlando. The fraternity announced Wednesday that, and they did this on X. That was Twitter's, that's Twitter's new name, X. They announced on Elon Musk's platform that Governor DeSantis is harmful, racist, and insensitive, and his policies against the black community are making them move their general convention out of Orlando. Willis Lonser III is Alpha Phi Alpha's general president, and he said that last week's controversy surrounding new education standards in the state became the tipping point in this fraternity's decision to move out of Florida for their convention. So, there you have it. Alpha Phi Alpha looking for a new place to go. Are they the Q Dogs? I apologize. I don't know all of my fraternity lingo, and I was not in a fraternity. The only fraternity I'm in is the South, which is a pretty good fraternity. By the way, we're taking nominations. Alpha Phi Alpha started at Cornell, of all places. Its colors black and old gold, and they have over 900 chapters and a total of nearly 300,000 members of Alpha Phi Alpha. And I think, and I apologize if y'all know for sure, I think their nickname is the Q Dogs. There's one of the black fraternities that makes a big deal out of getting the brand on their arm, and it's a big deal. Now, I don't know if that's an official policy, but most of them have it as far as I've been able to see, and pretty intense. That thing is, okay, I'm sorry. Maybe it's Omega Psi Phi is the Q Dogs. I think that's who that is. There's a couple of these black fraternities, and they all, and then the sororities too, to their credit. They, I believe the term is represent, and they do it rather well. But this fraternity out of the one that started at Cornell, Alpha Phi Alpha, choosing to move on and go to a different place. They haven't announced where that is going to be. May I suggest any of the other southern states their fraternity? If you're in North Texas and you're looking for rice, you might be out of luck. I'm not talking about rice as in the university down in Houston. I'm talking about the world's largest rice importer, or rather exporter, has imposed a new ban on one of its most popular grains, and it is now hard to find this. Over the weekend in Dallas-Fort Worth, customers cleared the shelves and waited in long lines for this type of rice. Rice, North Texans fearing a rice shortage because of the exporter imposing a new ban on one of its most popular grains. I'm trying to come up with the actual name. It looks like it's the non-basmati white rice. and it's an Indian rice. So maybe that's why, if you're not Indian, of Indian heritage, and you're not necessarily looking for this type of rice, this makes no difference to you. But evidently, North Texas has a large number of Indians and Indian Americans, and they're having a problem finding this rice. So, might have to get back to old whatever the other rice options are in today's world. Is it Mahatma? Is that one of the rice blends? I usually get the old store brand, and it works just fine for me. So, good luck there, rice shopping in North Texas. Let's bring you up to another story we want to tell you about. This involves two of our southern states, and it is involving the Lacey Act. I'm going to have to Google this one real quick. The Lacey Act. Did you learn about this one when you were studying as a little boy or a little girl in school? I had never heard of such a thing until I pulled this story up. The Lacey Act, which was first started back in 1900, it combats the trafficking of illegally taken wildlife, fish, or plants. And back in 2008, a farm bill amended the Lacey Act and extended protections to a broader range of plants and plant products, making it unlawful to import certain products without an import declaration. But it looks like the Lacey Act prohibits you from taking wildlife across state lines. I think that's essentially what it's about. And I didn't know that. And guess what? Two men out of North Mississippi have now been sentenced to a year of probation, and they have to pay a total of $30,000 in fines and restitution for illegally killing white-tailed deer. A man out of Hernando, Mississippi, Christopher Jones, age 42, and a man just down the interstate from Hernando, out of Senatobia, 42-year-old Heath Harris. These two men killed deer in Tennessee and then transported them across state lines to their native Mississippi. According to court documents, Jones and Harris both pled guilty to one count of violating the Lacey Act for killing a white-tailed deer in violation of state law and then transporting it across state lines. According to prosecutors, back in December of 2019, these two killed a white-tailed deer on property west of Chullahoma Road, which is north of Jackson Pitt Road in Memphis. Y'all know where this is located? I didn't know there was any kind of road named Chullahoma in Memphis. But they evidently killed a deer there, and then they violated Tennessee laws in the process, including hunting in Tennessee without a license. No, don't want to do that. After killing that deer illegally in the volunteer state, they then transported it into Mississippi. And I didn't know this was a big deal, especially in terms of a deer. There are too many deer in Tennessee and Mississippi and just about every other state. I didn't think it was a violation. I get they needed to probably have a permit in Tennessee, but sheesh, that's pretty hard. That's pretty tough there, a violation of the Lacey Act, and these guys getting in a heap of trouble. But they're not going to have to go to jail, it looks like, sentenced for illegally killing deer in the state of Tennessee. But it must be a federal violation they're having to deal with this Lacey Act. So be careful, y'all. Be sure you know exactly where you are. And I don't know exactly where that road is in Memphis. Of course, Memphis is right on the border with Mississippi. So that road could stretch down near State Line Road, and maybe they just got confused and thought they were in Mississippi. Or maybe they just had illegal things on their mind that day. I don't know, but they got that deer. I hope it was worth it. I wonder how they got in trouble for that. I wonder how they got caught. Did they take it into a taxidermist or something, and the taxidermist has to know where your deer is killed? I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not enough of an outdoorsman, so I'll refrain from weighing in. And as we wrap up our news headlines for this hour, have you seen the new movie Oppenheimer? I have not. I want to. It's a 3-hour film that just came out this past weekend, and it ended up number 2 in box office sales, trailing only Barbie. And, of course, Oppenheimer, named after J. Robert Oppenheimer and his work developing the first nuclear weapons at Los Alamos in New Mexico. All that part of Project Y, now known as the Manhattan Project. This is a film that really showcases America's involvement in the production of nuclear weapons and how Oppenheimer's work led to America dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which helped bring World War II to a close. The connection to Oppenheimer directly is the South, specifically East Tennessee, because the Manhattan Project, as it was being developed, they built facilities at the Clinton Engineering Works in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and that's where they worked to develop and produce fissionable uranium isotope. As a result of the Manhattan Project, the work there in Oak Ridge helped lead to the first atomic weapon and the bomb Little Boy dropped on Hiroshima August 6 of 1945. And that thing used two masses of uranium that helped come out of Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And if you go to Oak Ridge, not just to see the Oak Ridge Boys, I believe they're going to be mostly up in Hendersonville and the Nashville area, but the Oak Ridge Visitor Center has information on the development of the Manhattan Project more. So there's actually even a short film on the project and its work in Oak Ridge. So check that out if you're looking for a place to go here in the South that ties into the Manhattan Project. Certainly want to go to the Oak Ridge Visitor Center. Also in Oak Ridge, you got the American Museum of Science and Energy. And it opened its doors way back in 1949. And they've got plenty of information on the Manhattan Project there. And you can learn about energy leadership and environmental restoration all at the American Museum of Science and Energy in Oak Ridge. Plus, there's a lot of options in Oak Ridge. Also, on Robertsville Road in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, they've got the Oak Ridge History Museum. And that thing's got a detailed timeline of Oak Ridge's history with a bunch of information coming from General Leslie Groves, who was the chief administrator of the Manhattan Project. Got displays about him there at the Oak Ridge History Museum. And don't want to leave out also the K-25 History Center in Oak Ridge. And K-25 is the gaseous diffusion plant, which was a part of the Manhattan Project. And this History Center has information about the plant and how it worked on the Manhattan Project all the way through the Cold War. And check it out. All in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, a connection to the new film Oppenheimer, which is in theaters right now. I want to see it. I just don't have 3 hours to go see it this week. I'll have to push it back to next week. When we come back to you with more news headlines in hour number three, we've got the breakdown of the most beautiful college campuses in the country and one great college in Georgia is high on the list. And I'm going to brag on Berry College out of Georgia for being the highest ranked Southern school on this list of the most beautiful colleges in the country. Travel and Leisure Magazine is the outlet that came up with this ranking. So we'll brag on Barry, but I'm going to tell you about who else showed up in the 25 most beautiful college campuses when we get to our final hour of today's Y'all Show. Plus, we got news out of South Carolina. As a young boy in the Low Country, got some inspiration from his childhood hero. And I'll let you know that feel-good story to wrap up our news headlines of the day when we come back to you in hour number three. But right now, we're going to take a little commercial pause for the calls. And when we come back, we've got country music news and notes. We're going to let you hear a little Billy Currington and Shania Twain music because those two were singing together in the last few days, and I'll tell you how and why that happened. Plus, Chris Stapleton has got new music coming, and we'll let you know about his forthcoming album, all that right here on the Y'all Show. And of course, we've got more coverage from the ACC Media Days that we'll be getting to all right here on the program that's Southern and ain't afraid to tell you about it. mail@y'all.com is how you can email us, y'all.
Hey, Billy.
Yeah?
I'm having a party. Wanna come?
Nah, I don't think so, baby.
Oh, come on. It's gonna be lots of fun.
I can come.
This ain't just any kind of party.
No, I think I'll stay at home.
No, it's gonna be really, really hot.
Starting to sound good.
I'm gonna put you on the spot.
Maybe, maybe I should.
There'll be lots of one-on-one.
It's a good day.
Come on, enjoy the fun.
What should I wear?
I tell you that. Doesn't matter what you wear, 'cause it's only gonna be you and me there.
I'm having a party, a party for two.
Nice little song from about 20 years ago from Shania Twain and Billy Currington. And I'm going to tell you about those two teaming up for the first time in two decades in Michigan. How in the world could they have gone up there and sung without singing right here in the South, maybe in a place like Nashville? But they didn't. I'm going to tell you about Billy Currington and Shania getting back together, as well as some Chris Stapleton news, as it's our country music spotlight right here on the Y'all Show, the show that shakes the Southland. But let me catch you up with a couple of texts that have come in to the program during our commercial break. As we were going through the news a few minutes ago, we mentioned that the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity is going to take their convention out of Florida because of mainly Ron DeSantis. Texter here says, well, bye-bye, Alpha Phi Alpha. I'm sure Florida is devastated. And then goes on to add, Q's get the burn on the arm. We were talking about the black fraternity that got the massive brand they put on their arm. Q's get the burn on the arm. Kind of stupid, don't you think? No, I mean, if you're into that, I know when I was in college, some guys that I were, my roommate and a few other guys decided to get a brand on their arm. And it's really unusual. And I don't want to sit here and tell you I know a lot about the human body. But when a Caucasian, at least I think I'm right on this, when a Caucasian brands themselves, it turns into like a pink-looking, nasty, nasty thing. And for whatever reason, again, I don't claim to know enough about the body, but it looks like, based on what I see with those Q Dog brands, a black person, it looks like when they get a brand, unless there's some trick that I'm not aware of, those cute old things like bubble up. It's like a three-dimensional type thing on their arm when they get those brands. It's pretty intense, man. It's actually kind of cool. And that's why they do it. I'm sure it's also a way to show off their fraternity. But yeah, my guys that got brands, which they shouldn't have done, I'm sure they regret it later. But the branding's not something that you need to be doing. Leave that to cattle. Leave that to the cattle farmers to do the branding. But some interesting stuff. Didn't know I'd get carried off on talking about branding and black fraternities on today's Y'all Show. But you know what? Here on this program about the South, hey, we cover it all, y'all, including what's going on in country music. So back to Shania and Billy Currington. They got back together at the Faster Horses Festival in Brooklyn, Michigan. The last few days they were together, and Currington joined Twain on stage to sing for the first time with her in two decades. During the performance, Shania asked the audience if fans were ready and launched the performance with a kick so high her ankle appeared level with her eyes. And they performed side by side with fans singing along. Twain actually co-wrote the song Having a Party with her ex-husband Mutt Lange, and it was on her 2004 Greatest Hits album. And if you remember back to that time, she had this country edition of Having a Party, or Party for Two was the actual name of the song. Party for Two was a country song with Billy Currington, but it also was released to pop radio, and on the pop version, Mark McGrath was the singer with Shania Twain. And then there's a couple of really cool music videos. Mark McGrath was the Sugar Ray frontman. And so you had the two songs that went out. And I think the country version of this got to number two on the charts. A successful song for Shania Twain. And if you go back to 2004 when this was out there, I think this was her last big hit in country music. Party for Two, Shania Twain. Before that one, she had It Only Hurts When I'm Breathing. She had had a couple of years there where she didn't have much success on the chart. Her last number one was 2002's I'm Gonna Get You Good. So it's been over 20 years since Shania Twain has had a number one song, but she's out touring. I'm excited for that. Good for her. And good that Billy Currington back on stage. In fact, Currington hasn't been as visible as Shania, but he got a new song out there recently called City Don't. And he puts new music on his social media accounts. So Billy Currington getting a little love alongside Shania and getting a little love right here on the Y'all Show today. And let's just be real, y'all. For a guy, Billy Currington's a good-looking guy. And he looks real good snuggled up with Shania in the picture that I'm seeing from this Michigan concert. And of course, Shania. Do I need to mention anything about her? The Canadian. The worst thing about her is she's from Windsor, Ontario. 57 years young. Shania Twain. So, we'll see if they get back together for any other music. Remember, another guy, an Oklahoman, was her first duet partner. Brian White, From This Moment, was a huge song. I actually was talking to Brian White's manager back in 1995, 96, when he told me that Brian had actually gone over to London to record that song with Shania Twain. And the guy's name was Marty. And Marty actually now works for, I think he works for Marty Stewart with Marty's museum, if you will, that he built in his hometown of Philadelphia, Mississippi. I forgot Marty's last name. But I remember hanging out with him, and he was telling me that Brian White was going down to record a song with Shania Twain. And I thought that was a little unusual, that combination, because Brian White at that time was a lot younger than her, and still she could have got anybody to go into the studio and record with her. She was the hottest thing going for sure at that time. And yeah, From This Moment On with Brian White was a massive hit in 1997 from the album Come On Over. And again, Marty told me they recorded this in London, and I'm looking at the background of this song to see if he was lying to me. I'm pretty sure that it was recorded there. From This Moment On. That's not what I want. Anyway, I'll look it up. But Shania and Billy Currington together in Michigan. Other country music news we want to tell you about here on this Thursday edition of the show, all about music and fun and sports and what else is going on. The Vanderbilt alum, Chris Stapleton, in the news. He's got a new album, and he has announced the new album is going to be called Higher. And it's coming out November 10th. The debut single for it is White Horse, a song that Stapleton wrote with Dan Wilson. And it is on the radio right now. Higher, with songs like South Dakota, The Fire, The Day I Die, Crosswind, and more. Chris Stapleton, alongside Dave Cobb and his wife, Morgane Stapleton, all produced the new album. And he recorded the album's 14 songs at Nashville's RCA Studio A. That is awesome that he recorded that right there on Music Row. His last album was Starting Over back in 2020, and Stapleton really is turning a corner. I wasn't overly impressed with him when he first came out, mainly because I thought that a lot of praise went his way for what he did with Tennessee Whiskey, the old George Jones song, which is a good song. I like George Jones's version a lot more than Stapleton's. I thought Stapleton, it's just kind of boring in my opinion, but man, people love that song. But his songs of late from this last album that came out a few years ago, now that's some good stuff. And there's no denying that Chris Stapleton is truly a country music singer. In a world where there are plenty of singers that you have to scratch your head and say, why aren't they rap artists? Why aren't they pop artists? Why don't they go follow Taylor Swift out to Hollywood and do stuff with her? Ain't no denying Stapleton's got the voice, the look, the sound, the songwriting skills, the production skills. He is right where he needs to be, Music City, USA. And if you can stick around a little while, you can hear White Horse on a radio station near you, the latest single from Chris Stapleton. And don't forget, coming up in November, just before the turkey arrives, November 10th, Higher, the latest album from Chris Stapleton. Now, back to one of those people I'm just bashing you about. Guys that, why are they in country music? But they are, and they've had success. And I'm going to tell you about Jelly Roll now, my fellow JR. Jelly Roll and his wife, Bunny Grant, and this is a great story, and I don't mind sharing this with you here, they've helped grant a dying woman's last wish. And I'm going to tell you about it. Jelly Roll, one of the biggest names in music, he and his wife, Bunny, met with a Nashville lady named Suzanne Durham, who is a terminal cancer patient. She posted a video to TikTok stating that meeting Jelly Roll and going to one of his concerts was her dying wish. So the James Best Foundation, a nonprofit that grants a last wish to adults battling fatal illnesses, they shared the video, and that thing got seen by more than 400,000 people. And Miss Durham is a former Nashville house manager for women recovering from drug and alcohol addiction, and that is a cause close to Jelly Roll and his wife Bunny to their hearts, as I do believe Jelly Roll is a recovering addict. So on Wednesday, that foundation, the James Bess, B-E-S-S, not best, as in them Dukes, James Best of Duke's Hazard fame is what I was referencing there. The James Best Foundation. They gave Jelly Roll a chance to come out and meet Durham. The patient was overcome with emotion and gave Jelly Roll a huge and long hug, and they sat down for a chat. She couldn't attend a concert, but Jelly Roll brought the concert to her as they gathered around, and Jelly Roll did a variety of his songs and even did Creature, one of his own songs. So Jelly Roll meeting up with this Nashvillian, Suzanne Durham, and helping her enjoy what looks like one of her final days as she's got this terminal illness. Thank you, Jelly Roll, and his wife, Bunny, for helping a dying woman in Nashville. And lastly, Tony Bennett died at the end of last week, died at age 96. But I wanted to let you know that there are some country music connections to the crooner that captured so many hearts for such a long time. Tony actually performed at the Grand Ole Opry way back in 1956, and throughout his career worked with artists like Carrie Underwood, the Dixie Chicks, Willie Nelson, and so many more. So yeah, he might have been the big city guy, but he still had a connection at times of his career with country music in Nashville. So just thought we would salute one of the music greats of the 20th century, Tony Bennett, and specifically how he tied into Nashville just a little bit, okay? When we come back, we're going to wrap up this hour of our show that is all Southern with a quick look at the ACC kickoff. We've got some audio coming in from Mike Norvell, head coach of the Florida State Seminoles, and that is coming up right after this. little Tommy Hawk chop as we welcome you back into the Y'all Show. And no, it's not for the Atlanta Braves or the Kansas City Chiefs. It's for the originators of the Tomahawk Chop. Got to give Deion Sanders credit for this one, too. Florida State Seminole football. We're going to spotlight the Noles here for a moment as FSU was at ACC Media Days on Wednesday. And we're going to go hear a little clip from their head coach, Mike Norvell, the 41-year-old Irving, Texas native who started at FSU after coming from Memphis in 2020 is when he was hired in Tallahassee. And here from Media Days in Charlotte on Wednesday is a clip of Norvell on Wednesday talking about his team and more.
You know, it's anytime you get to Media Day, it's just, it's one of those the kind of benchmarks in your timeline that, hey, you get to this point, you know, it's close. And, you know, watching our team throughout the summer, you know, the way they've worked, the growth that we've had, you know, the physical growth, the mental growth. I mean, I think our guys have approached, you know, this off season with the right mentality. And you know, it's a daily process. It's you know, something that is, we're working to put ourselves in the best position for August 3rd and the opportunity to get on the field and go, you know, start putting, you know, on display to ourselves, you know, what this team's going to be. And, you know, I've really enjoyed watching this team grow. I've enjoyed the, you know, the relationships. I've enjoyed the work ethic. I've enjoyed the response. I mean, we're challenging these guys in every area, and you know, 'cause we have to get better. And that's the sole focus on within our program is just improvement. And I think these guys, you know, they're starting to celebrate the hardship of what it is to get better. And you know, it's been fun to watch.
That's Mike Norvell, head coach of FSU, the Noles, with a huge first week opponent. September 3rd, it's LSU. Remember, Florida State knocked off the Tigers last year in New Orleans. This year at Camping World Stadium in Orlando, it's round two between the Noles and the Bayou Bengals. The Noles have their home opener at Doak Campbell against the Southern Miss Golden Eagles on Saturday, September 9th. Then they have their first ACC game at Boston College on the 16th of September. Clemson is the opponent. They play the Tigers in Death Valley. That's going to be a huge game on September 23rd. But Mike Norvell, again, entering what would be now his 24th season already? Yeah, that's about right. Uh-huh. Man, time flies. You know what? Time flies. We have wrapped up our sports report for this hour. We've wrapped up this hour. We'll be back with hour three of the Y'all Show after this. Of this Thursday Y'all Show has arrived. The General of the South, John Rawl, that would be me, welcoming you in to our little program we call the Y'all Show that is available in podcast form on Spotify, the TuneIn app. We're also on the iHeartRadio app and the Apple iTunes and Apple Podcast apps. Check it out. We're also at y'all.com, the South's homepage. And in this final hour of this Thursday Y'all Show, we've got more headlines coming from across the nation, and then we'll package in some fun stuff, including the most beautiful college campuses. You know, all the little kiddies are packing up their belongings right now, getting ready for college. Some people have already arrived for college the new semester. It just depends. Some colleges don't get going until nearly the end of August, but some of them are really, honestly, already underway. And Travel and Leisure magazine has just ranked the most beautiful college campuses in the country. And I'm going to tell you what Southern schools ended up on this list. So that's part of our news headlines today. Plus, a really neat story from a South Carolina boy who got a special message from Gordon Ramsay. I wonder if Gordon yelled at him. He better not have. But this young man, a 7-year-old with cerebral palsy at the Medical University of South Carolina needing some special attention. And guess what? Gordon Ramsay comes through. I'll let you know more about this in our news headlines of the day. But right now, we start off with a little bit more of the hard news. The big story from the last 24 hours or so nationwide is Hunter Biden. Where's Hunter? Well, Hunter was in Wilmington, not hanging out at his daddy's garage looking through the classified documents there near the, was that a Corvette, I think he had there? I didn't even pay attention. But no, Hunter was there Wednesday trying to get a plea deal through the process, but Judge Mary Ellen Norica had a different plan. She's the U.S. District Court judge there, a Trump appointee. And in Wilmington, she raised multiple concerns about the specifics of the deal that Hunter Biden had already worked out, and also raised concerns about her role in the proceedings. There's an agreement on a separate gun charge, as Biden has been accused of possessing a firearm when he was a drug user back in 2018. So Hunter Biden, who had hoped to come into Wilmington and get a lot of this legal stuff behind him Wednesday, did not quite go down the way he wanted. And this is a big talking point amongst the Republican establishment, as they believe there is a definite double standard going on here for the privileged and powerful, of which Hunter Biden's both. Yeah, he's got his daddy as the commander-in-chief of the world who totes around a nuclear football, and they've got a lot of money. And some people call it the crime family, the Biden crime family, because they've been taking money from people around the world for a long time. And people like Hunter had no reason or purpose for being on boards like Burisma and involved with China and Ukraine and other countries. So the son is likely going to keep being a problem for the father. And we'll just have to see how well Joe Biden dances around this ongoing saga of his son. I know the guy's got problems, but problems aside, there are some serious, serious things that he was doing that would affect our nation's national security if he truly is working and getting paid by the mayor of Moscow's wife, or China giving him millions of dollars for a guy who's completely unqualified. This is not a good sign for Joe Biden, the more Hunter stays in the news. Moving on to other headlines across the Southeast today. Teachers in Tennessee suing over the state restrictions on CRT curriculum. They say that laws need to be clear. The Tennessee Education Association, along with five other public school educators, filing a lawsuit against the Tennessee Commissioner of Education and members of the State Board of Education as they're challenging the constitutionality of the restrictions placed on teaching racial and gender issues. This lawsuit filed challenges the Prohibited Concepts Law, which passed back in 2021, and that bans certain subjects and topics from being taught in classrooms. The Teachers Union claims that the law prohibits teaching of core subjects in Tennessee state standards, which puts teachers in an impossible position and deprives students of a quality education. So what exactly got left out? One person said that the laws need to be clear. The Prohibited Concepts Law conflicts with the state's own academic standards and curriculum, which creates unfair risk to Tennessee teachers using state-approved materials. The penalty, there is a penalty for teaching when you're not supposed to some of this stuff, as the law prohibits schools from teaching the concept that an individual should be discriminated against or receive adverse treatment because of the individual's race or sex. And the law also says an individual's moral character is determined by the individual's race or sex. Again, more on the legislation. Tennessee's teachers are prohibited from instructing students that an individual by virtue of the individual's race or sex is inherently privileged, racist, sexist, or oppressive, whether consciously or subconsciously. Again, prohibited from telling students that individuals are privileged. Basically, it's a white privilege law. They're trying to keep teachers from pushing, especially on minority students, in a classroom setting, that white Tennesseans are automatically and inherently privileged. That's what it all comes down to. And this was passed, and Bill Lee, the governor, signed it into law, and now a big effort by the Tennessee Education Association to sue and try to get this thing thrown out or at least revised, as it calls into question the unconstitutionality, vague language of the law, and the subjective nature of its enforcement. That's the story out of Nashville this week. The story out of Montgomery, Alabama, the Speaker of Alabama's State House is citing Nancy Pelosi on social media. Alabama's state legislature in the news because of their failure to get a map that would be good enough for the Supreme Court of the United States to approve. They're trying to expand Alabama to have another black district with their congressional maps, as the state legislatures, that's one of their responsibilities every 10 years, I think it is, after the census is taken. And the Supreme Court of the United States already slapped Alabama on the wrist and said, this is not going to work. Well, the Speaker of Alabama's State House is Nathaniel Ledbetter out of Rainesville in northeast Alabama. And he has gone on social media and called out Nancy Pelosi, saying, thanks to Speaker Pelosi's leadership, America is tanking in debt. Families have to spend $13,000 more a year, and criminals are running our streets. Alabama is doing better than the feds because we don't take advice from liberal activists like Nancy, with the hashtag pipe down Pelosi. Pelosi was recently on CNN on State of the Union with Jake Tapper, bashing Alabama for their failure to get another black district. This new congressional map that the people like Ledbetter passed has been signed into law by Kay Ivey, the governor of Alabama. So we'll find out what goes on in Bama as this case continues on. Calling out Nancy Pelosi. I like that. Now, let's check in. I got a text here that I want to tell you about. Oh, he's referencing Hunter Biden. Here we go. John, pervert Hunter Biden has done things that would land you and me and the rest of your listeners in prison. He gets a free pass. It just doesn't work. Thank you for that text. Hunter Biden, and kind of ties in with the story I was just telling you about out of Tennessee with the white privilege law. I wonder if Hunter Biden was black, if he would have been able to get away with some of the stuff he's gotten away with. Or is it because of his last name? I don't know. But, I appreciate your text there. Again, you can text us here at the Y'all Show or email us mail@y'all.com. So let's move on now to a completely different subject, to getting away from politics and all the other problems with race and the bad stories, frankly. Let's tell you about something beautiful. Y'all ready for this one? We got a list of the 25 most beautiful college campuses in America, thanks to travelandleisure.com. And at least one Georgia college has landed almost at number one. They're at number two. I'll tell you about that in a second. But Travel and Leisure, going throughout the country, rating the top 25 most beautiful college campuses. As you might be getting ready to send your little one off to college for the first time, we want to tell you, hey, these are some great places. If you haven't considered them, to at least go take a nice tour and see just how beautiful they are. According to TravelandLeisure.com, the 25th most beautiful college campus is Flagler College, the private liberal arts college in St. Augustine, Florida. It actually includes part of that college campus, the Ponce de Leon Hotel, that was built in 1888. And it does look like an incredible college campus. Flagler College, St. Augustine. Congratulations. Nashville's Vanderbilt University has landed at number 24 as on campus there at VU. They've got 170 species of trees on their 300-plus acre campus. And often right there on West End of Nashville, you can see hawks, owls, cardinals. I don't think you see too many bald eagles. You better not see any vols running around on Vanderbilt's beautiful campus. It's number 24 on this list. Greenville, South Carolina's Furman University is number 23 on the most beautiful college campuses list. There's actually an 18-hole golf course on Furman's campus. It's a 750-acre wooded campus north of downtown Greenville, home of the Paladins. Furman, FU, number 23 on the list of most beautiful college campuses. Moving up the list, there's a couple of Yankee schools, so I'm not going to mention them, but number 20 out of Williamsburg, it's the College of William and Mary, America's second oldest college, named for its Royal English founders, William and Mary. And I've been there. It is a lovely place. 1,200-acre campus just right outside the city of Williamsburg. I mean, it's right there in the city, but it's a great place. Man, I love the men's store that I visited there and got I think I got a nice regimental tie when I went to Williamsburg and visited the town and the College of William and Mary, number 20 on the most beautiful college campuses list. Moving on up on the list, you've got coming in at number 16, Duke University. We got a lot of Duke talk this hour of the Y'all Show. We're going to hear from their head football coach in a few minutes, Mike Elko. But Durham's Duke University is number 16 on the list of the most beautiful college campuses, according to Travel and Leisure. And if you go to Duke, you will see the nice collegiate Gothic, they called it in the article, Wonderland. But it does have a Gothic-inspired theme there. And it's a great place. Although I have not been to Duke's campus. I've been to Durham, but somehow I was in a hurry, didn't make it to the campus. So I'll just have to take their word for it. Duke coming in at number 16 on the most beautiful college campuses list. UVA in Charlottesville is the number 14 most beautiful college in America. It's actually designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Thomas Jefferson designed the UVA campus, and they've got that famous main building there that he designed and more. And of course, just down the road from the campus is Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home. You'll also find on campus early printings of the Declaration of Independence. And I've been on that campus. I've been to Edgar Allan Poe's room there at UVA. It's pretty neat and a great town. Charlottesville and UVA coming in at number 14 on the most beautiful college campuses list. Now we get to the top 10 of this, and we've got coming in at number 9. How about you, Sewanee? As the University of the South, right on top of Mount Eagle Mountain, a 13,000-acre rural campus on the Cumberland Plateau. And, of course, Sewanee and the University of the South is the Episcopal College of the South, essentially. And a lot of people have summer homes up on Mount Eagle Mountain. But it is a great place, and I've gone by and checked it out. And you'll find there at Sewanee the Tennessee Williams Center, named after the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who left his estate. I didn't know that. Tennessee Williams left his estate to the University of the South, a.k.a. Sewanee, once a member of the Southeastern Conference. And it is the 9th most beautiful campus in the country, according to TravelandLeisure.com. Rice University in Houston checks in on the list at number 7. Of course, this is right in the middle of a very, very large U.S. city. But Rice's 300-acre campus is lush. It's divided into quadrangles, and it's got thousands of elms, hickories, maples, and other trees there. Lovett Hall is one of the oldest buildings on campus, and it borrows from medieval Southern European architecture in its design. So a great looking campus there. Rice University in Houston, checking in on the list at number 7. Coming in on the list at number 4 is Florida Southern College, good old FSC. And that is a surprise. This is in Lakeland, Florida, where you'll find Florida Southern. And it's actually on a hillside overlooking Lake Hollingsworth. And it has there at Florida Southern the world's largest collection of Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. They've got the Annie Pfeiffer Chapel, which has colored pieces of glass and a wrought iron tower. And it was dubbed the first uniquely American campus by Frank Lloyd Wright and was named a National Historic Landmark back in 2012. Go visit in Lakeland, Florida, Florida Southern College, the fourth most beautiful college campus, according to travelandleisure.com. Number 2 on the list, and this is our highest ranking Southern school. We want to congratulate Berry College in Georgia, located in Mount Berry College. It's got the world's largest contiguous college campus with more than 27,000 acres of fields and lakes and forests and mountains. Berry makes prime use of its setting too, with numerous reflecting pools and fountains nearby its beautiful English Gothic inspired buildings. The Ford Dining Hall is an example of that. And the school's largest benefactor, why did they have a place I said called the Ford Dining Hall? Because Berry College's largest benefactor, Henry Ford. I'm kind of curious the connection he would have to a college in Georgia. But sure enough, Berry College, according to this website, checks in at number 2 on the most beautiful college campuses list in America. By the way, Mount Berry, where this is located, is in Floyd County, which is northwest Georgia. Rome is where we're talking about. And I've been to Rome. I've just never been to Berry College. See, this article gives me a reason to go check it out. And how about this? Mount Berry, where Berry College is located, is actually named after a woman, Martha Berry. Martha Berry was an American educator and the founder of Berry College. I did not know that. And this town named after a woman who was born in Jackson County, Alabama, which is where Scottsboro is. And she lived up until 1942. She was a lady who was born right after the Civil War. And she found a way to create a college, Berry College, and then Mount Berry there in Rome established that she had a hand in establishing. So what a story there with Berry College in Mount Berry, Georgia. And I was looking to see if it is tied into any kind of religious. It is a non-denominational Christian college with over 2,300 students there in the Rome, Georgia area, home of the blue and white. What is it? I'm trying to find out what their athletic nickname is, because they do play sports at Berry College in Georgia. Some kind of eagle or some kind of bird, I know, because I'm seeing that their mascot is Victor. No, I'm sorry, the Vikings. So they're the Vikings. My apologies, Berry College, founded back in 1902 as Berry Industrial School. So there you have it. Enough talk about college campuses. I want to thank again Travel and Leisure for coming up with this list. Pretty amazing. Gives us all a reason to go check out some more college campuses across the Southeast. And lastly, a story out of the Lowcountry of South Carolina. A 7-year-old from Ladson, which is just north of North Charleston. This 7-year-old with cerebral palsy has been baking for a while for his MUSC care team. That's the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. And he's been baking. He loves to bake. His name is Chef Ace. We're talking about James Ace Williams, the 7-year-old. And he discovered his passion for baking by watching his favorite chef, Gordon Ramsay. Well, Gordon Ramsay saw a story about Chef Ace on WCSC, I believe is the call letters, Live 5 News in Charleston. And Gordon Ramsay sent a message to him. This 7-year-old with a cerebral palsy receiving the message. And Ramsay said in the video that he just wanted to tell him how proud he was because your journey has been incredible. Gordon invites Ace to come meet him the next time he's filming MasterChef or MasterChef Junior. How about that? So a nice, nice job, Gordon Ramsay. I'm glad he didn't yell at Ace, Chef Ace, as he sent a special message to the Charleston, South Carolina area to this youngster who's, again, having a tough fight with cerebral palsy. And we wish him all the best. James Ace William, a.k.a. Chef Ace, we are pulling for you, sir. And go bake up something rather tasty. When we come back on the Y'all Show, we're going to bake up something real nice for y'all. Because we've got a Southern sports update. We've got from the ACC Media Days, the head coach of the Duke Blue Devils, your reigning ACC Coach of the Year, Mike Yelko. We'll find out more about what he's got in store for 2023 for the Blue Devils, as well as we'll give you an update on the latest on the college football conference realignment scene, as it looks like the Colorado Buffaloes are being courted to go to the Big 12. Are they indeed headed that way? We'll get the latest on that and so much more as we will continue on again. Drop us an email any old time. M-A-I-L, mail at y'all.com is the way to do it. And we'll be right back with Talk About Those Blue Devils right here on the Y'all Show. Those Duke Blue Devils, welcome back. It is the Y'all Show, and we're going to talk about Duke football and more. Mike Yelko had his first season leading Duke in 2022, and it was a rather successful season. In fact, Duke just extended Elko's contract through 2029. We're going to talk about Duke and more. I want to remind you, this is the Y'all Show. We are the Southern Show, and you're welcome to include yourself on the Southern Show anytime through our email address, mail@y'all.com. And we've got our Southern Sports Report before we get out of here in a few minutes on the Y'all Show. We'll have our breakdown of great festivals going on across the South this very weekend. So make sure you get your pen and paper out for all that fun. But let me get your pen and paper out and give you some info on the Duke Blue Devils, because Elko, again, doing a great job in his first year. He went 9-4, and they even won the Military Bowl as the head coach of the Duke Blue Devils. Going back to last year, Duke started off with 3 straight wins. They won against Temple, Northwestern, and then they beat North Carolina A&T in front of 32,000 fans there at Wallace Wade Stadium. That was the biggest game at home they had all year from an attendance standpoint. Then, remember, Duke played Kansas back in September of last year, and it was a battle of unbeaten teams, and Duke barely lost that game to KU. Some basketball powerhouses getting together on the gridiron. It was a great contest. But Duke would rebound. They got a victory at home against their rival, UVA. And then they actually went on the road to Bobby Dodd and lost to Georgia Tech. And I think that would have been Jeff Collins's maybe last game as a winning coach for Georgia Tech. Then in the Victory Bell game against their arch rival UNC, it was a close contest, but there at home they lost by just a field goal to the Tar Heels. But then they reeled off 3 straight ACC wins. They won against the Miami Hurricanes at Hard Rock Stadium. They won on the road at BC, and then backed all that up with a win against Virginia Tech. They would lose to Pitt, but end up beating Wake Forest in a close 34-31 contest to close out the regular season. And then they would play the UCF Golden Knights in the Military Bowl at Navy Marine Corps Stadium in Annapolis. And they dominated UCF and Gus Malzahn 30-13. And Mike Elko picking up a very, very impressive first season at 9-4. A team that, coming off of the final year of David Cutcliffe's era, was 3-9 back in 2021. And 0-8 in ACC play. And Cutcliffe would exit, and in comes Texas A&M defensive coordinator Mike Elko as the team's new coach. And boy, what a job he did. This is a guy who played his college football for the Penn Quakers. He's a Jersey boy, 45 years old. And just a tremendous, tremendous first season for Duke. I would put this right up there with what David Cutcliffe even did. I know Cutcliffe ended up going to an ACC championship game, but for goodness sakes, this guy won Coach of the Year in his first year at Duke, and they were 0-8 prior to him coming in there. Mike Elko was at the mic on Wednesday while he was in Charlotte, just down the road from Durham, and he took questions from reporters regarding his football team. Let's go in and hear from the second-year head man of the Duke Blue Devils while he was at ACC Media Days in Charlotte.
Yeah, that was the message in February, was every year is different, you know, and no different than we were a 3-9 team that became a 9-4 team, and 3-9 had nothing to do with 9-4. You know, 9-4 is going to have nothing to do with how this season plays out. And I think our kids really embrace that this offseason. You know, there's a price you have to pay for success in college football that you got to pay yearly. And you see that, like, across the board, you know, of teams that are off the radar that have really good seasons, teams that get a lot of preseason hype that don't. And all of that stuff is getting decided right now behind closed doors with work ethic and people doing the things they need to do to give themselves an opportunity to have success, and we're doing it.
You look around the locker room and go, okay, I know what he's done. It feels like Coach Mike. I felt the last year, you just feel like, okay, I've got the same opinion this year.
Yeah, I mean, you don't know until you go out in fall camp and you really start practicing. I know we're better. I know we're a bigger, faster, stronger team than we were last year. I know we understand schematically and fundamentally what we're trying to do and what we're trying to execute better. You know, now are we gonna really be a team that's willing to lay it all on the line and do it play in and play out over the course of 3 hours? That's what we build in training camp, and that's what training camp will show us.
All right, that was Mike Elko of the Duke Blue Devils talking Wednesday at ACC Football Media Days in Charlotte. And I'm pulling up the schedule for Duke football for 2023. They actually start their season in a huge, huge way. They're going to be playing Clemson. They got a ACC game to start their schedule in 2023. And this game, I think, is going to be the primetime game on Labor Day night, if my thing will pull up here correctly. What a way to start the year, Duke and Clemson. And sure enough, that's going to be Saturday, rather. It's going to be Saturday on Labor Day weekend. No, it is going to be Monday. It's a Monday game, Monday night football, and it's going to be in Durham. Clemson comes to Wallace Wade Stadium for the opener for the Blue Devils. Clemson and Duke on Labor Day night, September 4th. That's going to be on ESPN. Duke then plays Lafayette for us Southerners, a FCS team, on the 9th of September. Then they play the very, very troubled Northwestern Wildcats, come down to Durham on the 16th of September. Then it's at UConn. Then they've got Notre Dame, the homecoming game, on the 30th of September. They play a triangle rival in NC State on the 14th of October. Remember, the ACC got away from division play, so they're playing a lot of teams they didn't play in the past. They are at FSU October 21st. They play at Louisville on the 28th of October. Arch rival Wake and arch rival North Carolina show up back-to-back November 2nd and 11th, respectively. Then they play at UVA on the 18th of November and close it out with a game against the Pitt Panthers on November 25th. But Elko's got a big challenge if he wants to back up his bowl trips, and it will show off in a big way on that season opener, Labor Day night, Duke Blue Devils and Clemson Tigers from Wallace Wade Stadium. Ha! Huh? Great, great to see that matchup in the opening weekend on Labor Day night. Now, at the podium today, if you're in Charlotte or catching ACC Network, if you have that, the coaches showing up today, Jeff Hafley of Boston College. You got Dabo Swinney and a couple of his players. Clemson at the mic in Charlotte today. Mack Brown and the UNC Tar Heels. He's bringing along his very highly touted quarterback, Drake May, over for the media day's opportunity. Then the other two schools in North Carolina that haven't been on the podium yet, Dave Duren and the NC State Wolfpack will be at media days today, as well as Dave Clawson and the Wake Forest Demon Deacons. And that wraps up our coverage of ACC for today. I want to also let you know that the Colorado Buffaloes, it looks like, are going to be Big 12 bound. They're voting any day now, any second now, on a possible shift to moving from the Pac-12 to the Big 12, a conference they were a part of for a very long time. So we'll find out if prime time is going to be prime time back in the Big 12 with this Colorado Buffaloes coming up. I want to tell you about something out of the NFL first, but we do have a couple of callers standing by. Let's go in and see if they've got something sports on their mind here on this Thursday. Yep, lost you there. Let's try this number here. And you're not there either. So, again, sorry about that. You can reach us here at the Y'all Show, 731-554-1170, when we're able to get calls in successfully. The NFL story I wanted to tell you about, Aaron Rodgers, kudos to the former Cal Bear. He's actually taken a $35 million pay cut in his deal with the New York Jets. So impressive that this guy, who's been a little bit of a problem child in the offseason with his contracts and trades and all that, but with his new team, Aaron Rodgers taking a $35 million pay cut. It's great to see all the NFL teams in camp, and I think a lot of teams had their first official practice on Wednesday, and they're moving into pads starting at the first of next week. But it's definitely football time, and we're excited to tell you about it. And again, excited to tell you all about what's going on with the Atlantic Coast Conference. We'll have coverage on our Friday show of all those coaches who were speaking on this Thursday from Uptown Charlotte. And that wraps up our sports coverage here for the final hour of this Thursday Y'all Show. When we come back on Y'all, we've got a breakdown of some great festivals taking place across the Southeast, from a celebration of hot dogs to some great music being played this weekend. I'm going to tell you how you can get to it when the Festive South feature is arriving, and it arrives right after this.
I'm supposed to mow the grass today. I'm supposed to fix the fence. But with the sun beating down on me, it's hard to make it make sense. Half of me wants a cold beer. Yeah, that's the cold hard truth. And when the refrigerator stops full of them, tell me what's they born to do.
You know what? There's going to be probably a cold beer or two served up at Jerk Fest South Georgia, North Florida. That is in Valdosta, Georgia. That is where the Rhett family calls home. At least that's where his daddy, Rhett Akins. Did I say Rhett? The Akins family is what I meant to say. Valdosta, Georgia, down in South Georgia, is where you'll find a cooking contest, live music, and vendors. This weekend, it's Jerk Fest right there in Thomas Rhett's ancestral home, and that'll be at the Lowndes County Civic Center. This is the Y'all Show. This is our Festive South feature, and we're going to spend the next few minutes telling you about some awesome things going down this weekend. If you don't have plans, hey, get in the car and go check out some of these great options across Dixie. Again, in Valdosta, just off of I-75, you can go and check out Jerk Fest this weekend. And if you're on I-75, you make it that far, hey, you might as well go on to Epcot, because this weekend at Epcot in the Orlando area, it's the Epcot International Food and Wine Festival. And that goes on Friday from 9 to 10 p.m., 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. Epcot, a food and wine festival. You better be careful, though. I'd hate for you to get kicked out of Epcot because you had a little too much wine. Elsewhere across the southeast this weekend, in Farmerville, Louisiana, it's the annual Louisiana Watermelon Festival. That's going on there, put on by the Farmerville JCs. Saturday starts bright and early. If you want to have a great Louisiana watermelon, Farmerville is the place to be. This weekend in St. Genevieve, Missouri, that is between Cape Girardeau and St. Louis, they're celebrating International Tiger Day. And I know where St. Genevieve is. It's just off of, what is it, I-59 on the interstate that goes through the Boot Hill and goes up to Cape Girardeau and then scoots over towards St. Louis. And St. Genevieve is a lovely little place. It's a French town, essentially, right on the Mississippi River. Great place to go visit. But I did not realize that St. Genevieve is the home of the Crown Ridge Tiger Sanctuary. And they are helping celebrate this weekend International Tiger Day. And the Crown Ridge Tiger Sanctuary is a nonprofit big cat rescue and educational facility that provides, they provide permanent lifelong care for abused, neglected, or unwanted big cats. And they are a true sanctuary. They do not buy, sell, breed, or trade any of their animals. They believe the ideal home for wildlife is in the wild, and that all animals, both in captivity and in their native habitats, deserve to be treated with respect. I went to their website, and that is crownridgetigers.com, and you can look at some of the tigers they have there. I don't know the exact head count, but a bunch of tigers, like real-life tigers, hang out in St. Genevieve, Missouri, and this weekend they're celebrating International Tiger Days. You'll also find some tigers hanging out in Columbia, Missouri, home of the university. But this is actually the real tigers. I don't think Truman is down in St. Genevieve. But they're celebrating International Tiger Day. And you can go sometime and check out this great sanctuary for tigers in St. Genevieve. CrownRidgeTigers.com is the website. In Miami, not the one in Florida, but the one in Oklahoma this weekend, it is the Route 66 Heritage Festival. I bet you there's a bunch of old cars that will be finding their way to Miami, Oklahoma this weekend. Hickson, Tennessee. I was afraid to announce this one, but this is something that some of you might really be into. It's the third annual Testicle Festival going on at Camp Columbus in Hickson, Tennessee. That's right beside Chattanooga. A Testicle Festival is an event held where the featured activity is the consumption of animal testicles, usually battered and fried. I think I'll pass. This weekend in Radford, Virginia, it's the Mary Draper Ingalls Festival. Now, I had to look this up. I love history, but I was not familiar with that name, Mary Draper Ingalls. And she was an American pioneer and an early settler of Western Virginia. And in the summer of 1755, she and her sons were among several captives taken by the Shawnee after the Draper's Meadow Massacre during the French and Indian Wars. They were taken to the intersection of the Ohio and Scioto Rivers, and Mary Draper Ingalls escaped with another woman after 2.5 months, and they went over 500 miles crossing numerous rivers, creeks, and more to get back to their native Virginia. That's pretty gutsy. And in Radford, Virginia, this weekend, they celebrate Mary Draper Ingalls, and they've got a festival in her honor. How about that? This weekend in Killeen, Texas, it's the Killeen Aloha Festival. I love that. That's at the Civic and Conference Center in Killeen. Aloha, y'all. And you can get your aloha on in Killeen this weekend. I love this one. What a great combination. Does it get any better? In Aiken, South Carolina, this weekend, it is the Barbecue and Sweet Tea Festival, and it's going down at Generations Park. In North Carolina this weekend, in Rocky Mount, they got the 2023 Down East Music Festival, and that's going on in Rocky Mount. Now, what is Down East? That refers to the areas of eastern North Carolina, east of Beaufort, and it includes Beaufort and Carteret County. The Crystal Coast is where we're talking about, and they're proud of their area of North Carolina. Carteret County and the coastal plain region of that state, Beaufort, a great, great place. Again, Crystal Coast of North Carolina. I've been there. It's just awesome. It doesn't get the fame that the Outer Banks does, but if you're looking for a good vacation spot, consider Carteret County and the good folks in the Down East. And they've got the Down East Music Festival taking place this weekend. In Pearl, Mississippi this weekend at Clyde Muse Center, it is the Mississippi Wildlife Extravaganza. I bet you the dress of the day will be camouflage. Columbia, Maryland this weekend, it is the Outlaw Music Festival, and Willie Nelson will be part of that fun going down at the Meriwether Post Pavilion in Columbia, Maryland this weekend. In Dawson Springs, Kentucky, it's the 75th annual Dawson Springs Barbecue Fest that goes at Dawson Springs, which is a place near, I guess it's kind of near Paducah. It's in both Hopkins and Caldwell counties. And Dawson Springs, Kentucky got their barbecue fest going on this weekend. Fort Smith, Arkansas is a place to be. They got the Peacemaker Festival. That's a music festival going on. Shane Smith and the Saints and Marcus King among the folks on the docket for that one. And that is this weekend, again, in the Natural State. And also, as we wrap up where you can go this weekend, in Mobile this weekend, it's the Gulf Coast Ethnic and Heritage Festival. And that's at the Mobile Civic Center. Make sure I haven't left anything off here on our breakdown of what's going on festival-wise. Oh, Huntington, West Virginia this weekend. It's the West Virginia Hot Dog Festival at Pullman Square. And that wraps up what's going across the South. And that wraps up our Y'all Show Thursday. We will see you Friday on the show that shakes the South. Y'all.